Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Memorial Day is behind us, which means summer to us up here in New England. Time to head to the coast or the lake or find a local pool or swimming hole to cool off. The urge to jump into water may feel instinctive on a hot day, but it is a learned behavior among humans. Despite the ease of Olympic swimmers Michael Phelps and Missy Franklin's, humans are not, in fact, born to swim. And that's on a planet that's nearly three-quarters covered by water. All that natural water and more than 5 million residential pools and 1,400 water parks in the U.S. alone, we begin to understand more clearly why drowning is the fifth leading cause of death in this country. James McWilliams is an historian and author of the Things We Eat column at Pacific Standard. His piece, A Brief History of Drowning, is in Pacific Standard's water issue, and we reached him on Skype. James, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
So what is our attraction to water then? Something that we weren't, according to the evolutionary biologists that you spoke to and others, that we weren't made to be in?
It's such an interesting question, and there's no consensus on the answer, but I think it's fairly safe to assume that our resources, as we developed as, you know, Homo sapiens, our resources were simply better spent, more profitably spent running, walking long distances and running in the effort to acquire food as hunters, as gatherers, as scavengers. And it's also, I think, quite possible that being in water may have ultimately been a very dangerous thing. You can't see what's around you. Unlike if you're standing on a hill overlooking a savanna, you have a certain level of safety because you can see clearly whatever potential dangers are around you. If you are in a body of water where there are all kinds of hazards, this is not the case at all. And so it's really quite possible that in terms of enhancing our safety as humans evolved, it just didn't make sense to learn how to swim, despite the fact that we were around so much water. The evolutionary biologists that I talked to all sort of gave me a version of one of those two explanations, and they seemed perfectly reasonable to me. And they also noted that we did wade into water to wash clothing, to, you know, to bathe, to fish. But in terms of actually learning how to swim, it may have been more dangerous and more energy consuming than was necessary in order for us to evolve as the human beings that we are today. You know, all that said, it still is a kind of compelling paradox. I mean, these kind of explanations only go so far. And, you know, on some level, there's always going to be a little bit of mystery as to why it is a healthy human being learns how to walk without any assistance whatsoever. But it really takes some work to learn how to swim. And that work gets harder as we get older. Research from my article, I attended an adult swim class, and it was really a remarkable thing to see because I watched these otherwise perfectly athletic adults walk around in waist-high water, absolutely terrified as to what they were doing. And it really hit home that we have very little in our, you know, DNA that's innate when it comes to swimming.
So good news, I guess, for people who don't take to the water like a fish. I guess we're not meant to.
That's the question that really got me interested in writing this article is, I mean, anyone who has raised children knows that between, you know, the period when your child is an infant and a toddler, they just naturally learn to walk. You don't have to do much to support that. And I kind of wondered why this was not true for swimming as well. And so that was kind of the paradox that got me interested in researching this article. And there are certainly all kinds of evolutionary explanations, some of them more hypothetical than others, as to why we don't naturally swim. But the fact is we don't. And as a result, it poses a bit of a problem, on one level, a public health problem that we could probably stand to be more vigilant about.
So how common is drowning? I mentioned the fifth leading cause, according to the CDC, of death here, but much worse, I guess, for children.
That's right. So, it varies according to the particular demographic that you're talking about. But with young children in particular, it is a very big danger, perhaps even the second leading cause of death. between the ages of 1 and 5. The reason for that is I think we underestimate how easy it is to drown. You know, small children can drown in a few inches of water. And this isn't intended to be sensationalistic or create unnecessary fears, but it is to highlight the fact that, you know, again, because we don't have this natural inclination to swim, because we have to be taught to swim, and frankly, taught to swim well, you know, a single lesson isn't going to do it. The preconditions for these kind of accidents are far more pervasive than we might estimate them to be.
And of course, it's not just inability. It's, you know, sometimes it's not wearing life jackets or not supervising children well enough. But also, drowning disproportionately affects particular other populations in this country, like who?
Well, I mean, the obvious answer to that question would be groups of people that don't have access for socioeconomic reasons to swimming pools and swimming lessons. And in certain parts of the country, this falls heavily on African Americans. In other parts, it falls on Hispanics. It's not as clear cut as, you know, we might like it to be in terms of getting a better understanding of the problems. But, you know, my assessment in the end was that this really is a socioeconomic issue. Those who have access to the resources, the leisure time to pursue swimming lessons are far less likely to experience a drowning incident. One of the more interesting conversations I had in doing research for this article was with a couple of medical professionals at Seattle Children's Hospital who had taken a very careful look at why people drown. And one of the reasons that they found was that a lot of swimming pools have very specific requirements about what you can wear. They require a formal bathing suit. Well, a lot of groups of people swim in cutoff shorts and don't wear kind of formal bathing suits. And they're turned away from swimming pools and will often end up going to another body of water that doesn't have any sort of lifeguard protection. And as a result, will, you know, put themselves at greater risk. And so these medical professionals spend a great deal of time working to kind of liberalize what, or, you know, we are allowed to wear at swimming pools. So to me, that's very interesting because it raises sort of the most unexpected places to look for achieving swimming safety, even for those who already do know how to swim.
James McWilliams is with us. He's an historian and writer, and he wrote A Brief History of Drowning for the Water issue of Pacific Standard magazine. What are some other things that are being done to get the number of drowning fatalities down?
There are certain kinds of regulation fences that need to be put around private pools, and very often they're not. You know, really common sense stuff like that. The availability of life preservers, the number of lifeguards at a swimming pool. I mean, none of this is really rocket science. But I think probably the biggest one, and I think the reasons that there are a lot of drownings that could be prevented, is we're not very good at recognizing what drowning looks like. We have a kind of Hollywood idea of what drowning looks like, and that's usually a person screaming with their hands waving as they go down into the water. And in fact, that's not what drowning looks like at all. Again, going into this research, I sort of thought that's what drowning looked like, and coming out the other end, I realized it's really a dangerous misconception. What drowning looks like is actually the person will just be gasping. They will not be yelling. They will be gasping for air. Their head will be back, and they will assume a vertical position. And then I think most interestingly, they will actually, in that vertical position, push their hands down as if they were trying to lift themselves out of a ditch. And that's not something we really think about when we think about somebody drowning. So very often it happens and people are around and it's not recognized. I mean, you hear those stories quite a bit. There were many, many people around and a person drowned. How could that possibly happen? And I think a lot of it comes down to this misconception of what drowning in fact looks like. And, you know, the fact that we're not aware of that, I think, again, speaks to the general lack of education, even among those who have access to some of the best swimming instruction about what drowning looks like and how, you know, pervasive and you know, possible it is to drown, even for those who do know how to swim.
Well, you mentioned that the incidence of drowning is greater in populations or people without means, but I do know people who are, you know, fairly strong swimmers. One caught a couple of years ago in the undertow at Martha's Vineyard. So it is not by any means exclusive to people who don't know how to swim.
No, that's absolutely right. My own children, I have two children, and they're teenagers now, but my kids have had access to the finest swimming instruction available, and they're both very strong swimmers. But whenever I'm particularly in a body of water, a natural body of water, if we're on a lake, if we're near a river, if we're in the ocean, just as a father, one of my greatest fears is that my children would drown. And I think it's a bit of an irrational fear, but at the same time, I have chosen to really listen to it and be kind of hyper vigilant around water, I think often much to my kids' embarrassment. But the fact is that you're absolutely right that even those who would seem to have all the bases covered in terms of avoiding drowning can still drown. And, this is just to remind ourselves, particularly in summertime, that we must have a really healthy respect for the dangers involved in swimming. Swimming is a beautiful thing. I love swimming, and there's nothing in many ways kind of more elegant than swimming or watching somebody who really knows how to swim well. But nobody's immune. One woman I interviewed, interestingly enough, she was an African American woman who didn't learn to swim until she was in her 40s, but took to it very well. In fact, her swimming skills progressed to the point that she was entering competitions and winning these competitions. And what I really took away from my conversation with her was her persistent fear, continued fear of drowning. She talked extensively about how every time she gets in the water, she is able to tap into that fear. And she thought it was a healthy thing. I mean, it still terrified her a little bit, but she was able to remember what it was like not to swim. And despite the fact that she was such a strong swimmer now, it persisted nonetheless. And I guess on some level, what I'd like readers to take away from the article is that, again, none of us are really protected from this danger. It's very easy to think we're not. And in fact, just this morning, I went for a swim in a nearby quarry, but I really thought to myself, don't swim out too far. Be very careful. I was the only one there. And so I think, these just having that awareness is probably not a bad idea.
James McWilliams, an historian and writer, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
James writes the Things We Eat column for Pacific Standard, and he wrote A Brief History of Drowning also for the Pacific Standard's water issue. There's a link to read it yourself at wordofmouthradio.org.